walk across the courtyard towards the library. I can hear the insects buzz and the leaves beneath my feet.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the August show of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. I'm Athenia, host and producer of Dog-Eared Reads, and I'm happy to be bringing you our one-year anniversary show. And I'm going to change things up a bit for today's show. For our Beyond the Cover interview this month, I'm going to re-air the interview that we did with Sandor Katz, author of Wild Fermentation and the Art of Fermentation, because now that summer's here and we're all out gardening, we might want to be thinking about fermenting again. I think it's a really timely interview. It was also a fantastic interview that we did with Sandor Katz, and it was a great workshop that Sandor Katz gave to the Kodiak Public Library when he came to visit last July. It was actually one of the top events of the Kodiak Public Library last year, and we're very proud of it. So I want you all to listen again to all the amazing ways that you can ferment foods. Before we get to that, though, because it's summer, I think we all need some summer reading books. So the first half of our show today is just going to be book reviews. I've done a book review of my favorite book that I read this year. I've got James Rains has come back and given me a wonderful book review of Armada, and Leanne Schnelsenbach also has joined me for a book review of a book she really enjoyed. Those are some new book reviews, and I've also got a couple of book reviews that aired on previous shows throughout the year that I thought might be good summer reading books, so I've included those reviews for you as well. So today on the show, all that you're going to get is some book reviews and then the interview with Sandor Katz, because I want you to be prepared to have a fantastic summer. And with that being said, I'm just going to start things right off with my own book review. Imagining a scene. Well, I'd like to start things off today by sharing one of my favorite books that I read this year, and it is Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff, published September 2015. I initially picked this book because I noticed that it was one of Obama's top reads for 2015, and I thought it might be interesting. The brief premise on Goodreads says this book is about the key to a great marriage, which is not in its truths, but its secrets. And I think that's an interesting premise, and it was an interesting book. Now, this is not the typical kind of book that I read. My typical book is a quick beach read, escape fiction page turner. This is more of an intellectual read. Some people might call it a pretentious novel. There are a lot of unusual or more rarely used words that I actually had to look up. I kept my phone close by throughout this novel to check on the words I didn't know. This is the story of Matilda and Lotto and their marriage spanning multiple decades. It's a character study more than a plot-driven book, so it moves a bit slowly sometimes. The pace, especially in the first half of the book, is kind of slow. It takes a little time to get into it. I found the best way to read this book was to read it in bits and take time off in between. I didn't stay up all night reading this kind of book. This is the one that you want to kind of chew over. The imagery in it, the poetry of the language is really deep, and it sometimes takes me a little time anyway to absorb that. So this book took me longer to read than typical books would. But by the time I got into the second half of the book, it picks up a lot. Some of the plot lines do become really exciting and interesting, and the change in point of view from the first half and the second half of the book really make the second half fantastic. In a very similar way to Gone Girl, this book is written from more the point of view of the husband for the first half of the book, and then more the point of view of the wife through the second half of the book. Also, like Gone Girl, there are some twists at the end and a little bit of shock for the reader when you see the big discrepancy between their points of view. I often wanted to go back to the beginning and reread the sections from the husband's point of view because it was just like, did I miss a clue or something? It's just so different. How can they be in this experience together and have such amazingly different outlooks and motivations? I think that is really the book's greatest strength. The book starts with this young couple that had just been married a week ago, flaunting their beautiful, gorgeous bodies on the beach, and it evolves throughout Lotto's growth and development as a playwright. The characters themselves and their storyline is sometimes not very interesting, and the characters are not very likable. They can be really pretentious, self-serving, unrealistically extreme in some of their behaviors sometimes, but I don't think that actually detracts too much from the joy that I got from the book when I focus less on the people and more on the marriage itself. The marriage being a separate entity from each individual character and what it takes to keep a marriage alive, that was the story that I found interesting. That was the character that I found interesting. Their marriage throughout the book to outward people always seems perfect. And it's what goes on underneath that perfect facade and what goes on to maintain that perfect facade that is really the meat and potatoes of this book. Now, it's very different from Gone Girl. It doesn't have a psychotic ending. It doesn't have a happy ending for the characters necessarily, but the character of the marriage actually does kind of have a happy ending. And that's what I found really beautiful. I went into this expecting a book about what it takes to make a beautiful decades-long marriage succeed. And I really think I got a lot of that out of the book. Their marriage is realistically rocky and also survives. How that actually happens in its tiny details, that's what I still think about months after I read this book. This is the kind of book that, you know, was a little more challenging to get through, but stayed with me for a lot longer. Her writing is almost incomparably beautiful. It's fantastic. It's vibrant. It's really different from most other writers that I've read. And her characters, while the main characters I don't like so much, and a lot of the smaller characters I forgot really quickly. It's a long book, and so sometimes the characters at the beginning weren't really big enough in their own sense to warrant me actually remembering them for when they came back later in the book. But while they're in front of you, she does a great job of vividly portraying who they are. But the character of Lotto's friend Jolie, his childhood friend that maintains a strong presence throughout the book, that character I loved and loved to hate. I'm actually going to describe him by using a quote from the book by Lauren Groff, where Lotto, the character, says, "Jolie, hello! He is deformed, crooked, old and sere, ill-faced, worse-bodied, shapeless everywhere, vicious, ungentle, foolish, blunt, unkind, stigmatical in making, worse in mind, my best friend." So I would recommend this book to people that like a more thoughtful, intellectualized, poetic description of what it takes to make a marriage last through growth and change and trials and tragedies and the secret inner working of each individual within the framework of that successful marriage. If that sounds interesting to you, you'll like it. If you enjoy beautiful, amazing, almost poetic writing, this is also a book that you'd really enjoy. And once again, it's called Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff, published in 2015. I hope you read it, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
Today I'm going to be reviewing a book by Ernest Cline called Armada, published in 2015. First, I want to take a minute to talk about Ernest Cline himself. When I was in the lower 48, Ernest Cline was actually traveling around the states offering a book signing dinner where one would purchase tickets to the dinner and then get a book signed, which was a very interesting way of marketing, and it was the first time I heard Ernest Cline's name. He has published two novels, this being his second. His first novel was entitled Ready Player One and was a USA Today and New York Times bestseller. And I find his picture very interesting in his book as he is sitting next to a DeLorean and he has entitled himself a full-time geek. His books involve video games and pop culture from the 70s, 80s, and 90s and are definitely a thrill ride. This book is entitled Armada and it's the second book that he has written and it involves Zach Lightman. Zach Lightman is a young man who has lost his father at a young age. age. He is struggling with feelings of anger. He is in high school, getting ready to graduate, getting ready to move on into the world. And Zach Lightman, like his father before him, has an addiction to playing video games. He works in a video game store, and he enjoys video gaming. Now, what's interesting about Zach is that Zach has stumbled upon his father's journals, and his father's journals seem to indicate that there is a worldwide conspiracy that Earth has made contact with extraterrestrials, and that these extraterrestrials are not friendly and have declared war on all the inhabitants of Earth. And Zach's father's journals goes on to entail the evidence that he has collected that 70s, 80s, and 90s pop culture have been preparing individuals for this great battle between Earth and alien invaders. It goes on to list music culture. It goes on to list biographies and Carl Sagan's The Cosmos. Goes on to talk about the alien movies and all these movies that portray Earth coming together and standing against an alien invasion. And then one day in class, Zach believes he sees one of the very ships from his favorite video game, Armada, which is a game where you would pretend to be the pilot and you would fly around with the Earth Alliance protecting the Earth from the aliens. And then it becomes very interesting when an Earth Alliance ship, just like the ships in the video games, lands at his school to pick him up for recruitment against an alien invasion. I really like this book. I didn't know if I would like it. I'm not a big video game player. You know, it's filled with pop culture from video games early on, all the way up to modern video games, and kind of the culture has, it kind of shows how the culture has evolved in the video gaming world. And so I was hesitant, but a good friend of mine told me the first book, Ready Player One, was excellent. They weren't a video gamer either, and they really enjoyed it, and that I should give it a shot. So I started it, and I'll tell you what, I could not put it down. It was an excellent read. Being born in the 80s myself, I found it exhilarating to see all the pop culture that I grew up with being fleshed out and being used as evidence in some alien government conspiracy cover-up, which I found to be interesting. Had a lot of action. It had a lot of excitement. It tied in kind of the young genre, the video gamers, with kind of the old school video gamers from the 80s, the arcade style video games, all the way up to the modern visual goggled VR type video gaming. The characters were very credible. They encountered various types of problems. Really, the main problem was that UFOs were attacking the world. And all these young people, all the way up into people in their 60s who were playing video games since they were young, had come together to use virtual reality to save the Earth from aliens. It was pretty simple. My favorite character was Zach himself. Zach is going through a lot in his life. He goes from losing his father at a young age to struggling with the anger that comes from that particular problem as a young man, up until the point where all of a sudden all this responsibility of saving the world is cast upon his shoulders as an excellent video game player, as recruited by the Earth Alliance. I would have to say that I don't really relate overall to the characters and their skill at playing video games and how their skill at playing video games, which some might see as a worthless hobby or worthless talent, is actually the thing that saves the world. I don't really relate to that because, as I said before, I'm not a video game player. However, I did relate to his backstory of being an adolescent male, struggling with anger, you know, not really understanding one's place in the world, not really understanding the future and what it holds, and then really kind of being cast into adulthood quickly with big decisions. That's something that I related to, and I think anybody can relate to, whether you play video games or not. My favorite part of the book, I would have to say, is kind of the conclusion, the ending. I don't want to give it away for you, but it has an Ender's Game type of feel to it. Another one of my favorite science fiction novels, which also involves video games. And then my least favorite part of the book, again, as well, is the ending. It's a good ending, but it comes so quickly. The whole book builds up to the ending, and then the ending is very quick, very laid out. Everybody lives happily ever after. Boom, done. And I would have much preferred a longer, more drawn-out ending, more drawn-out conclusion. If I could change anything with the book, like I said, it would be the ending. I would change it and make it drawn out a little bit longer. But it does leave us in a little bit of a suspense as to, will there be a sequel? Is this the last of Zach Lightman? Or will we see him again later in an upcoming novel? I would definitely recommend this book. It's a great quick read that people of all ages can enjoy, whether you like video gaming or not. And I would say it definitely makes you desire to see the next work. This book is entitled Armada by Ernest Cline, published in 2015.
So my name is Leanne, and today I'm going to talk about a nonfiction piece by Nando Parado and Vince Rouse. It's called Miracle in the Andes. Miracle in the Andes is a story about Nando when he is a young man, a teenager really, at the end of his high school career. He was on a rugby team called the Old Christians. He's from Uruguay, and they were headed to a rugby competition over in Chile. On their plane trek, twin prop plane to get over the Andes, they ended up in a pretty horrific crash. The crash itself is the focus of the book and the survival. They managed to survive 65 days out in the Andes Mountains, and they think they're at 7,000 feet. It turned out they're really surviving at 14,000 feet with almost no supplies to begin with. They have very little to eat. They figure out how to melt snow for water, and then they have to make some very crucial and brutal decisions in order to keep surviving. Nando himself tells this story. The story has been written about before, called Alive, I think is the first publication of the story. But Nando decided to write about it because he felt like his friends had been portrayed in an unfair light. And so as he tells the story, he talks about what got him through and motivated him to walk out of the Andes Mountains to the west and down into Chile, which resulted in their rescue. I found this story incredibly difficult to read. I wept, for sure. It's very real, and it's brutal at times, but it's also amazing. Nando's focus is not on the horrible things that happened, but on the faith that helps he and his teammates ride through. I think the most beautiful part of the story actually is the conversations he has with one particular individual about God and God's purpose. And I would recommend this story to anybody who's interested, first of all, in rugby, because it has a lot of really cool stuff about rugby, or car racing, because it does talk about that later. But mostly it's something that I think people who have experienced any sort of survivalist kind of trauma, boat accidents, hiking accidents, anything along those lines, it's truly inspirational in that he can recognize how important faith was to him and how his faith was so drastically different from others. So that's Miracle in the Andes by Nando Parado and Vince Rouse, and it was published on May 9th of 2006.
This is Kate, and I am reviewing a book that maybe you haven't heard of called The Madonnas of Leningrad by Deborah Dean. It's published by Harper in 2006, and it's a short novel of historical fiction. And I came upon this book in our library here while looking for books about art and painters. And the author does render elegant descriptions of Hermitage paintings, which make you want to go to St. Petersburg, or at least tour the museum website. But the book turned out to be a little treasure in itself. Stories within stories. One of a young girl, Marina Buryakov, who worked as a docent in the Hermitage Museum at the outbreak of World War II, and how she kept her sanity by recreating the museum in her mind while coping with years of starvation, bitter cold, and relentless destruction. And I quote, "No one weeps anymore, or if they do, it's over small things, inconsequential moments that catch them unprepared. What is left that is heartbreaking? Not death. Death is ordinary. What is heartbreaking is the sight of a single gull lifting effortlessly from a street lamp. Its wings unfurl like silk scarves against mauve sky, and Marina hears the rustle of its feathers. What is heartbreaking is that there is still beauty in the world." End quote. And there's a story of Marina's love, Dmitri, her childhood friend and eventual husband, despite separation during the war. And the story of present-day Marina, now 82, struggling with the onset of Alzheimer's. As the details of her daily life slip away, the recollections of her youth become more vivid, and as her past overtakes the present, there are poignant scenes as family members try to understand. Like many war survivors, she never spoke of her experiences with her children, and they will never know her past story. From her husband's viewpoint, and I quote, "It didn't matter. The bond that first brought them together as children existed whether they spoke of it or not, the bond of survivors. Here in America, a relentlessly foolish and optimistic country, what they knew drew them closer together. She was his country and he was hers. They were inseparable, until now. She's leaving him, not all at once, which would be painful enough, but in a wrenching succession of separations. One moment she's here, and then she's gone again, and each journey takes her a little farther from his reach. He cannot follow her, and he wonders where she goes when she leaves." End quote. And there's a true story, that during the 900 days of the Leningrad siege, the staff of the Hermitage and their families, 2,000 people, lived in the basement of the museum. The staff worked frantically to remove the art pieces from the museum and ship them off for safekeeping. The frames, however, were left hanging in place, perhaps as a symbol that the paintings would return someday. One of the docents who worked there began to give tours of the museum to visitors, and it was said that he would describe them so well that the visitors could almost see them. There are other more compelling, better scripted books about the horrors of the war, or about the complexities of family relationships, but this book is so creatively constructed, and I appreciated its underlying gentleness despite the sadness. It made me consider that there may be moments of dementia that are not terrifying or upsetting. And I quote from the book, "One of the effects of this deterioration seems to be that as the scope of her attention narrows, it also focuses like a magnifying glass on smaller pleasures that have escaped her attention for years. She keeps these observations to herself. She once tried to point out to Dmitri the bottomless beauty in her glass of tea. It looked like amber with buried embers of light, and when held just so, there was a rainbow in the glass that took her breath away." He nodded sympathetically, but mostly looked concerned. End quote. Maybe we onlookers are the ones more lost and confused. Anyway, find your way to this book, Madonnas of Leningrad, by Deborah Dean.
Hey there, and welcome to another book talk with Katie and Nia. Today we are doing The Princess Bride by William Goldman.
Okay, Nia, this is my favorite book of all time. I know I say that about every book I read, but this one really is my favorite.
So this is a really interesting book because not only does it have a great plot and a great story and fabulous characters.
Fabulous characters. Their backstories are beautiful. Go on.
Thank you, Katie. The book is told from the perspective of a guy who read this book when he was younger and is now rereading it again.
So it's a book within a book.
Every so often, he'll interject and say what he thinks about a character or a situation. And it says on the cover, "The Princess Bride, S. Morgenstern's classic tale of true love and high adventure." Actually, S. Morgenstern didn't write the book. William Goldman is pretending like he is abridging the novel by S. Morgenstern, but really, it's not. It's his story. He made it up.
I think it's a genius setup, honestly. It had me fooled for like half the book.
Yeah, I figured it out today when Katie told me.
Yeah, okay. I love the elaboration and the backstory and the anecdotes in this novel. Like, the movie is fabulous, but it doesn't capture all these stories from these characters that come together, intertwine to make another story.
All the characters are so beautifully described in this book. You don't love all the characters, like some books make you love every single character they have. In this book, I actually hate one of the main characters because
who is this, Nia?
Okay, so first we meet Buttercup, who is a vain, spoiled, immature girl.
I resent that!
She gets everything she wants because she is really beautiful, and it's kind of annoying because she's not really smart at all. And then she gets jealous and decides she is in love with the farm boy named Wesley, who she treated horribly until she realized that she loved him, which I'm slightly skeptical of.
I, on the other hand, think Buttercup is fabulous. I don't think she is perfect, like Wesley.
Wesley, yes. Wesley the farm boy.
Oh, don't change the subject. I'm sorry, I'm getting heated now. I don't think she's perfect, but none of us really are. She was a girl when she was mean to Wesley, and she was just playful. And I think that she is smart. I don't know where I'm going with this. She's a good character. Okay.
Well, now let's move on to Wesley. Wesley, on the other hand, is perfect in every single way.
I know, he's totally unrealistic, which makes me love him even more. I think everyone who reads this book falls in love with Wesley because not only is he good-looking, charming, intelligent, and great with the sword, his love for Buttercup is so genuine that he doesn't care that she's immature and selfish and vain. What's your rebuttal to that?
I'm just gonna say that was underhanded and angsty, and I thought you were better than that.
But Wesley, he ends up leaving in the very beginning, and you think he's gone forever. But then, later, there's a plot twist, and he returns.
We're not giving away the book!
My second favorite character to Wesley is Inigo Montoya.
Oh my goodness, same!
His father was killed when he was very young, and his life's goal is to murder the man who killed his father. And so he spends his whole life training to become the best swordsman on Earth.
Inigo Montoya squeezes rocks for 7 years just to build up his strength. Dedication, my friends, dedication. He goes to the masters for so many years. How many years did he train?
For like his whole life.
For his entire life to kill the one man who killed his father. He is so inspiring. Honestly, I mean, I probably wouldn't have that much dedication to kill one man. But then again, my mother wasn't killed. My father wasn't killed by a six-figure man.
Inigo's line in the book that has become very famous, like through the movie too, is, "My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die."
That is a line that just,
boom,
it impacts you. Even though it's so commonly used nowadays. Out of all the things he could say, he could like yell at him. He could scream at him for killing his father. He could torture him. But he just goes straight to the point because that's really what his life was about. Getting straight to that point.
And not necessarily getting revenge, but just avenging his father. Not taking revenge on the person like, you ruined my life because you killed my father. It's more like, you took my father's life in such a brutal manner. You deserve the same. You have it coming.
Now, my other favorite character, which I'm going to tell you about all of these characters, is Fezzik.
Fezzik, who is like a giant, and he's not that smart, but it's okay because he is literally such a sweetheart.
He's
like
the nicest guy.
He is the epitome of gentle giant.
Honestly. And his backstory in this book, it's just brought me to tears a few times.
He was always teased because he was always bigger than the other kids and stronger, and he didn't really know his strength. And then his father started teaching him self-defense. So he wouldn't get picked on, and he ended up becoming like a wrestler or something, right? And so then no one likes him at the wrestling matches because he always wins and people don't like that. And so he ends up leaving and he meets up with Inigo and Vicini.
Vicini
is this kind of manipulative, intelligent, but rather cocky in the fact that he thinks he's more intelligent than everyone else,
which takes away from his intelligence.
He's a Sicilian, and that's kind of how they refer to him in the very beginning when they kidnap Buttercup, and they just refer to him as the Sicilian. So you're kind of like, who is this guy?
Yeah, I watched the movie before I read the book.
I did too.
I recommend watching the movie before you read the book because it was casted so perfectly that when you read the book, the characters' iconic voices will be in your head and it'll make it all the more interesting. Okay, this book has something for everyone. It has humor, romance, action, evil, good, revenge, giants, sword fights, battles of wits. Good guys, bad guys, lies, truths, death, life, and most importantly, true love. I did write that out beforehand. I'm actually quite proud of that.
I like this book because it has adventure, it has romance, it has sword fights, which are always fun.
They are indeed always fun. My favorite aspect of this book is the humor and the wit and charm that just flows. It's not like people trying to be funny. It's just like the characters, they know what they're doing. They know that it's funny. That brings me to another point, Nia. Each character has one or two defining qualities, which makes the book so interesting. Each one's so different.
Buttercup, the only thing she has is her beauty, honestly.
Peanut gallery over there.
No, seriously. Wesley, he's smart, he's dedicated, he's funny. Inigo is an inspiration.
Courageous.
Courageous. Fezzik is sweet, even though he's strong. He doesn't use his strength to his advantage or taking advantage of other people.
I actually see what you're getting at. Even the Sicilian, he is smart and he's determined. But Buttercup just...
she's just there.
I still like her a lot, though, because I feel like I can identify with her a little bit.
Katie, you're smarter than Buttercup.
Oh, thank you.
In the end, she becomes the exact same person.
She doesn't really change. Like, other characters develop. Like, Fezzik, he decides that he can be smart because I think he was kind of just convinced that he couldn't be smart and he was all brawn and no brains.
Mm-hmm.
And Inigo has finally completed his life's goal, and so he can now rest in peace and be happy. Wesley is finally with his true love and he is so happy. Buttercup's just like, well, I always get what I want. There's nothing different. You're gonna have to go and get a copy at the library. Anyways, thank you so much for listening. We had a great time talking about this book. I hope you go out and I hope you read it.
And I hope you form your own opinions on characters such as Buttercup.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed all of those book reviews brought to you by Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. I'm Athenia Large, host of the show, and I want to thank each and every one of our listeners. If you are interested in giving me a book review for a future episode of Dog-Eared Reads, I would love to have it. You can always contact us by emailing kpla.alaska@gmail.com. Or you can record a book review on your own device and then email that as a WAV file to us. You're also welcome to stop by the library and use one of their iPads to do a book review there, and they will get it to us. We would love to hear about what you're reading over the summer. We want your involvement. If you have any interest in participating with this show or volunteering for one of our many wonderful events that the KPLA and the Kodiak Public Library put on, or if you have any interest in perhaps joining the library board, we would love to have you in any way you would like to be involved with us. You can, of course, email us. You're also welcome to visit our website, www.kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. On our website, you'll find a volunteer form, you'll find a membership in case you haven't become a member of the Kodiak Public Library Association yet. You should. There is a way to do that on there through PayPal. And if you're one of those people out there that really enjoys using Facebook, find us on Facebook and like us. We have a lot of fun posts going up, and often the Kodiak Public Library will post on there what's happening at the library. So for those teen movie nights that are coming up, if you want to know what movies they're playing, the Facebook page is where to get all of that information. Please visit us there. Now, I would like to introduce our Beyond the Cover segment. This was the first interview that we ever aired on Dog-Eared Reads, and we're very proud of it. Sander Katz is a wonderful author and a very knowledgeable man on the many different ways of fermenting foods. If you haven't already checked out The Art of Fermentation from the Kodiak Public Library, you definitely should. Beyond just explanations on how to make so many different fermented foods, he also has a wonderful description in there of the culture of fermentation and some history as well. It's an interesting read beyond the recipes, which are also fantastic. So here's Sander Katz.
Welcome to Beyond the Cover, our segment in Dog-Eared Reads, where we'll talk with authors and guest speakers coming to the Kodiak Public Library. In today's segment of Beyond the Cover, we'll chat with Sander Katz, author of Wild Fermentation and The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, Inside America's Underground Food Movements. Wild Fermentation has been called the manifesto in the Bible for do-it-yourself fermentists. His most recent book, The Art of Fermentation, won the James Beard Award, and the New York Times calls him one of the unlikely rock stars of the American food scene. Katz lives in Tennessee and describes himself as a fermentation revivalist. He has given workshops and spoken all over the country. The workshop's description reads, "Come learn how simple it is to make your own kimchi, kefir, and other fermented delicacies. Learn about the healing qualities and the nutritional importance of live culture ferments, as well as their illustrious history and integral role in human cultural evolution. Empower yourself with simple techniques for fermenting these healthful foods in your home. Be part of the fermentation revival." Sander Katz, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What's fermentation?
Well, broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. Generally, we use this word in relation to foods and beverages. So they're foods and beverages that are created by microbial action.
And so what are some common ferments?
Well, I mean, you know, most people in most parts of the world enjoy products of fermentation on a daily basis. You know, one scholar actually estimated that one-third of all food that human beings eat has been transformed by fermentation before we put it in our mouths. Some examples would be bread, cheese, cured meats, coffee, chocolate. You know, the list goes on and on. I mean, up in the north of Alaska, you know, people never could have settled in the Arctic region without, you know, having techniques for effectively preserving, you know, fish and marine mammals from summer when the waterways are accessible to get them through the winter. So that's fermentation. You know, sauerkraut, kimchi, and other methods of preserving vegetables from seasons of plenty to get people through seasons of relative scarcity, that's fermentation. So fermentation actually has, you know, many varied manifestations. Soy sauce is fermentation, fish sauce is fermentation, vinegar, which is the base of all the condiments that, you know, we enjoy in the standard American diet, you know, those are all based on fermentation. So, you know, fermentation is very, very integral to, you know, culinary traditions, you know, in the U.S. and really in every other part of the world as well.
In your book, you talk about the difference between wild and cultured fermentation. What's the difference there?
Well, I mean, wild fermentation really describes fermentation based on the organisms that are spontaneously present on the food that you are fermenting or to a limited degree in your environment. You know, conceptually, you know, all fermentations had to begin as wild fermentation events in some particular place. But we've learned, you know, lots of different ways of perpetuating these cultures. So let's say something like yogurt. Yogurt, you know, began as a spontaneous event somewhere. The first person who made yogurt did not have mature yogurt to use as a starter. But if you or I want to make yogurt, all we do is get some, you know, mature live culture yogurt and use that as a starter. And so we perpetuate the culture by introducing a small amount of it into the next batch. You know, whereas something like sauerkraut, you know, nobody really uses a starter for sauerkraut because all the bacteria that you need are so abundantly present on the vegetables that you are fermenting. So you know, wild fermentation, you know, simply is a way of describing ferments based on the organisms that are present on the food, you know, or in the environment, whereas culturing implies that you're introducing some sort of a starter.
So then you recommend just using wild or cultured based on what type of fermentation you want, or do you usually prefer one over another for people just starting out?
Well, I mean, really, for most people, I would recommend as a starting place fermenting vegetables just because you don't need to obtain a special starter culture. It's all on the vegetables. You don't need special equipment. You can use a jar that's already sitting around in your kitchen. You know, there's no case history of food poisoning or illness. So in terms of, you know, people's projections of fear upon bacterially rich foods, you know, there's absolutely no reason to be afraid. You know, plus it's easy, it's delicious, it's supportive of good health, and you can enjoy your results relatively quickly. So I generally recommend that people start with fermenting vegetables, you know, something like sauerkraut. But, I mean, cultured foods can be very easy as well. I mean, you know, kombucha, you have to obtain a culture, but once you have it, the process of making kombucha with that culture is very straightforward. Yogurt, you know, yogurt involves a little bit of temperature manipulation, so that makes it a little bit harder, but it's not that hard. You just, you know, heat up the milk to about 180 degrees, cool it down to about 110 degrees, introduce the culture, and then you have to rig up something to incubate it and maintain it around 110 degrees Fahrenheit. I just use an insulated cooler that I preheat with hot water. So I try to keep things low tech and approachable for, you know, people to think about doing in their home kitchens. I mean, people have been practicing fermentation for, you know, at least 10,000 years with you know, tools that are much simpler than what you'll find in, you know, any of our contemporary home kitchens. So, you know, we definitely can do it in our contemporary kitchen.
So what compelled you to write The Art of Fermentation in your other books?
I got interested in fermentation, you know, largely through the experience of having a garden for the first time and realizing that all of the cabbage is ready at the same time. And so as a result of that, I learned how to make sauerkraut. And then one thing led to another, and I just became obsessed with all things fermented. But what I realized as I began to share it with people is people projected all of this fear on it. Like, okay, sauerkraut is a bacterially rich food, so, you know, So how do I know that I have good bacteria growing in my sauerkraut and not bad bacteria that might make my family sick or even kill someone? So, you know, I just realized that, you know, because of this general, like, cultural fear of bacteria, and, you know, that's our indoctrination into what I would describe as the war on bacteria, this sort of idea that bacteria in general are bad, people, you know, became very fearful of these, you know, important fermented foods. And so I decided that I would try to demystify fermentation for people and make it more more approachable. And I did that first in a couple of small workshops, and I realized how exciting and satisfying that was. And then I wrote a little zine that I self-published, and that led me into writing a book, which led me into further teaching and then ultimately another book. You know, fermentation is a vast, vast subject. I mean, there are you know, different fermentation traditions everywhere, and you know, in some of the traditions that have spread far, you know, there are distinctive local variations everywhere. So I mean, I just find it to be endlessly fascinating learning about fermentation, and also really, really fun to demystify it, and people see how easy and safe it is. And in fact, you know, fermentation has been a strategy for food safety. You know, and in general, the process of fermentation actually makes food safer than it starts out being.
So in The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation, you cite studies on the health benefits of fermented foods, as well as talk about how eating fermented foods have helped you with your own wellness and living with HIV. Can you share with us how fermented foods have helped you personally, but also what those health benefits are for everyone?
There's so many different fermented foods that it's hard to generalize. I mean, obviously, you know, salami, bread, yogurt, sauerkraut, and chocolate do not have, you know, identical nutritional qualities. You know, but the process of fermentation definitely transforms foods in some clear patterns of ways. So the first one I would describe is predigestion, and this is the idea that you know, complex nutrients, some of which can be difficult for us to digest, get broken down into simpler forms before we eat them. So nutrients become more bioavailable. Minerals in foods become much more bioavailable. Then there's what I would describe as detoxification, which is really the same thing as predigestion, except instead of nutritive compounds being broken down, it's toxic compounds being broken down into benign forms. And there are examples of foods all around the world that are toxic without fermentation and become safe to eat as a result of fermentation. Nutrients that are produced by the bacteria. So rather than just breaking down what's in the raw food that you're beginning with, it's metabolic byproducts of the bacteria. You know, some of these are B vitamins, and in general, fermented foods have higher levels of B vitamins than the raw foods you begin with. And some of these are unique micronutrients that are really just beginning to be explored. But, you know, for instance, in sauerkraut, there are compounds called isothiocyanates that are regarded as anti-carcinogenic, that are metabolic byproducts of the bacteria as they digest vegetables. Then finally, what I would consider to be the most profound nutritional benefit of fermentation would be live bacterial cultures. Not all fermented foods have live bacterial cultures. A loaf of bread coming out of the oven, the bacteria have been killed by heat. A can of sauerkraut sitting unrefrigerated on a shelf in the supermarket, that also has been heat processed, killing the bacteria. But fermented foods that are not heated or cooked after their fermentation contain living bacterial cultures, in many cases dominated by lactic acid bacteria. They can help to replenish and diversify the bacteria in our own intestine. And also they stimulate the immune system. It seems that they stimulate some of the brain chemistry. And so, you know, really every week there are new studies, you know, demonstrating just how important bacteria are to every aspect of our health and well-being. So, I mean, in terms of my personal health, I mean, sure, I've been living with HIV for, I guess, the 24 years now. And, you know, I take HIV meds. I mean, I wish the story I could tell you was just eating fermented foods, prevented the HIV from progressing in my body, and that's not really the case. But I can tell you that the meds that I take, most of the other people who I've met who take them have digestive problems as a result of them, and I've never had that. So I think that the fermented foods help keep my digestion healthy. My overall immune function has been great, and, you know, bacteria definitely play a huge role in our immune function. And so, you know, I think that, you know, regularly, you know, eating these bacterially rich foods has something to do with that. Unfortunately, there is a limited amount of, you know, structured research about this, clinical trials. I mean, you know, there's a vast body of clinical trials for probiotic capsules because those are all proprietary, and the owners of those proprietary strains, you know, conduct these expensive trials to demonstrate their effectiveness at all sorts of things. But nobody owns the traditional ferments, and so nobody's really investing in trials like that. So, you know, there's some evidence, but a lot of it is anecdotal. I mean, the latest bit of anecdotal evidence, which was very interesting, was that, you know, young people who eat sauerkraut experience less social anxiety. All sorts of, you know, aspects of, you know, well-being can definitely be affected by the health of the bacterial communities in our intestines. And it goes way beyond, you know, digestion and immune function.
So what do you think the next piece of research that needs to be done? Just looking into the natural probiotics that are in ferments themselves, or is there some more substantial or other types of research out
there? Yeah, sure. I mean, I would love to see clinical trials of, you know, just eating traditional fermented foods. I mean, it's not a question of not knowing what bacteria are in them. You know, I mean, they're broad communities of bacteria. Whenever you take, you know, raw natural ingredients, it's not like there's a single bacteria. You know, single bacteria is very much a technological idea. 150 years ago, Louis Pasteur did that for the first time. In the natural world, a single bacterium never existed. You know, bacteria exist in communities. And so, you know, all of the traditional ferments actually are embodiments of broad communities of bacteria. And frankly, that's what, you know, that's why I believe they're more powerful probiotic agents than capsules that contain, you know, a billion copies of one or two cells.
Well, it's wonderful to hear that it's been so helpful for you in your healing, and also for others you've talked to.
But I try to be very, very careful. I mean, I hear reports from people all the time who tell me that their digestion has, you know, dramatically improved, or that other health problems have. You know, but I think that, you know, there also are people who are making, you know, unsubstantiated claims. You know, there are people out there who say, like, oh, drinking kombucha is going to cure diabetes. And I think that it is unreasonable to expect a particular food to cure a particular disease. And we have to look, you know, more broadly and say that as a group, these bacterially rich foods can improve digestion, they can improve overall immune function, they might improve mental health, and they represent no risk. And they can be very helpful, but I don't think it's reasonable, and I've been trying very hard to not promote the idea that, you know, eating a lot of sauerkraut is, you know, will reverse HIV or anything else. It's much more general than that.
Right. Okay, let's shift gears here a little bit. There's a lot of interest and history in Kodiak and living off the land, collecting wild plants like seaweed and fiddleheads, collecting blueberries, salmonberries. Right now there's tons of salmonberries showing up, fishing. I know we can ferment most anything, but do you have any recommendations for fermenting these local foods that would taste especially good?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, where I live in Tennessee, there's a great tradition that people call country wine. And that would be like blackberry wine, elderberry wine. But you can use exactly the same techniques with, you know, salmon berries or other kinds of berries. So anywhere that is, you know, where people have access to abundant berries, I mean, I would encourage them to make simple country wines. I mean, my basic recipe would be fill up a crock or vessel with berries. The more berries you have, the better. Guesstimate, you know, roughly what the volume that the berries are filling, and figure about half that volume. Mix up a sugar water solution, about one part water, six parts water to one part sugar. So you make a sugar water solution, cover the berries in that, and then just stir it every day. Cover the, you know, stir the berries in the water really vigorously, and it'll start to bubble. Keep stirring them. You know, after about a week of bubbling, there's hardly any color or flavor left in the berries, and the color has all migrated into the solution. There's more liquid because the berries have lost most of their liquid into the solution. Strain it out, either enjoy it young as a very lightly fermented, still sweet wine, or else get it into an airlocked vessel and ferment it for a couple of months and then bottle it, and then, you know, you can enjoy a berry wine. You know, that's one great thing you can do. If you have fiddleheads or, you know, or greens or just vegetables from a garden, I would recommend, you know, fermenting vegetables. I mean, sauerkraut is generally what I'd recommend, you know, is the first thing for anybody to make. And, you know, if we have a couple of minutes, I could just describe the process for making sauerkraut.
Sure, go ahead.
Great. We leave vegetables out exposed to air, especially if we chop them up and make lots of surface area. That air exposure is going to support the growth of mold. And so our strategy for getting the lactic acid bacteria to dominate rather than the mold is to get the vegetables submerged. We could just pour water over them, but the water would dilute the flavor. So typically what we try to do is pull the water out of the vegetables. So you chop them up, you lightly salt them. I really recommend just salting to taste if you have no idea what to do with that. You know, think about, you know, 1.5% salt by weight. But just lightly salt it. There's no magic number. Just you trust your taste buds, and it doesn't have to be extremely salty at all. Just lightly salt them. The salt starts pulling juice out of the vegetables, and I like to get in there with my hands, especially if I'm doing a small batch, and just squeeze the vegetables hard for a couple of minutes. What you're doing is breaking down cell walls, bruising the vegetables, helping the cells release their juices. And you'll notice that the vegetables, after 5 minutes of that, get really juicy. You pick up a handful and squeeze it, and it's like a sponge, and juice comes out. Then you can fill your vessel. I would recommend using jars, like wide-mouth quart-sized jars. A quart takes about 2 pounds of vegetables, and you just sort of stuff it into the jar with some force, fill the jar nearly to the top, leave a little bit of space for expansion, press down the vegetables hard so you're forcing the solids down and liquids up so the vegetables become submerged. Then I like to ferment it right on my kitchen counter so I can loosen the top and release the pressure that's going to build up, because this is a life process that involves the production of carbon dioxide, so you have to release some pressure. And then while I do that, I press down and make sure the vegetables get submerged. And after 3 or 4 days of that, I start tasting it. And, you know, some people love their fermented vegetables mild after just, you know, 3 or 4 days. You know, people, you can leave them, especially if you have an unheated space, like a cellar. I mean, you could leave them, you know, for months and months and months, and they'll be just fine. I mean, this has been a strategy for survival in temperate places with limited growing seasons, and it's very easy to make. What I've described is a small scale, a quart, but, you know, I also do this in 55-gallon oak barrels, and you could do it in any scale in between, in a gallon jar, a plastic bucket, a ceramic crock. You know, there's lots of different vessels you can use, but a wide-mouth jar is something that's easily available and you might have in your kitchen already.
So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask one last question here. Kodiak has a ton of slugs, which gardeners are in constant battle with. And in your book, you mention an old-time method of pest control where one collects and then ferments a pest and then sprays it on the plants. Have you tried this method? Does it work? Could it work with slugs?
I couldn't tell you if it works with slugs. I have tried it with some other pests with mixed results, but I've never tried it with slugs. Right where I live, I don't have a big slug problem. One summer, I gardened in Maine, and we had a big slug problem. And what I found worked really well was putting cups of beer out, and the slugs would drown in the beer. So, but I think it would be a great thing to try.
Senator Katz, thank you for talking with us today.
Okay, well, I can't wait to come up there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Cover. Until next time, happy reading.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview we had done with Sandor Katz for our first show. Sandor Katz came to the Kodiak Public Library last July for a fermentation workshop, and we had a wonderful turnout, so I would imagine there are a lot of people out there now making fantastic sauerkraut. I'm going to end things today with a summer song for you. This song is by Xavier Rudd, one of my favorite artists. He's from Australia and Canada. And this is a song that inspires me to enjoy the beauty of the summer. I hope you all out there have a wonderful summer, and I'll see you again next month on Dog-Eared Reads. Thanks for listening.
Way the wind blows when this day is done.